Talk today is called Digging Deeper, because we are going to be digging deeper, and we're going to be digging deeper into the 13 points that we've been looking at for the last several weeks. And you have a kind of a partial abbreviated list there in your programs. We've had the full list many, many times, and I know that full list has been mailed out to so many different places by you and shared with friends and on refrigerators and everything, and it's wonderful. If you happen to not have had this, and if you'd like that, then you can just ask and we'll get one for you. And today would really be called part five, and each part we talked about is separate unto itself, but the thing is, when you put all these different things together that we've been talking about, that again came from the secular book written by Amy Morin called 13 Things That Mentally Strong People Don't Do, and again I added the spiritual component because I realized that all these things come from a spiritual foundation. If you put all these things together, and if you incorporate these things into your daily living, which takes some doing, takes some work and some intention, that together they are going to make a very, very strong difference in your well-being and your happiness and your ability to be able to deal with the tough times in life and to heighten the wonderful times as well. And that's what our faith and that's what mastering these things will do for you. And so today we're going to be focusing on number 9. Mentally and spiritually strong people do not resent other people's successes. Okay, so I say that and you hear that, and you know, I bet if I ask you, how many people resent someone's success, right? I would wonder how many hands would go up. I'll ask you. I mean, how many of you resent someone's success? All right. Well, now what do I talk about? Jeez, no. Not at all what I was planning. No, the thing is that, you know, of course we don't. We don't go walking around, resenting people's successes. But the interesting thing is, with that, Jesus told a parable. And the other interesting thing is that with all of us, who don't walk around resenting people's successes, when we read this parable as a whole, or you hear it, very often some feelings get stirred around it. And so I'm going to take this opportunity. I'll invite us. We're going to read this together, and it's printed in your bulletins. And before we do, just two pointers, since we're going to be reading out loud. I don't want you to feel embarrassed. There's a word in there that you might not know how to pronounce. It's denarius. Okay, it's a form of money. It's a sum of money. It's equal to one day's of wages back then. The other interesting thing is that it talks about, the third hour of the day and the sixth and so forth. The third hour of the day is roughly 9 a.m., and it was usually about 3 hours after sunrise, so the day would begin at sunrise. So the third hour, 9 a.m., sixth hour would be about noon, ninth hour, about 3 p.m., and then 11th hour is about 5 p.m. or so. So here we go, reading together Matthew 20, right? If you join me. Jesus says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. And after agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, 'You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you.' So they went, going out again about the sixth hour and ninth hour. He did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, 'Why do you stand here idle all day?' They said to him, 'Because no one has hired us.' He said to them, 'You go into the vineyard too.' And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, 'Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first.' And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the householder, saying, "The last worked only 1 hour, and you made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity?" Amen. May God bless our understanding and our living of this word of abundant, abundant life. So I wonder, having read this, does anybody here actually like this passage? Does it make you feel good and kind of give you that warm, fuzzy feeling? Anybody? No? Okay. Perfect. Perfect. Because that is actually exactly what I would have expected. And the interesting thing is when Jesus told this, this is exactly what he expected as well. That's why he told it. And with that, I just want to share a little story with you. And it's a story that that I first read about 35 years ago, and it was in a book called Zen and the Martial Arts, and it was at a time when I was practicing martial arts in my life. And it's written by a man named Joe Himes, and he said this. He said, "I first met Ed Parker, Kempo Karate Master, in 1952 in a Beverly Hills gym where he was teaching, and he taught a number of well-known people. And he says he was a 6-foot-tall, big Hawaiian who, he said, reminded me of a huge tree. He says his arms were like limbs, and his bare feet were just rooted firmly on the floor. And despite his size, he was a graceful whirlwind in motion. And yet his face, he said, was serene and peaceful as if he had just completed meditating." And Himes wrote, he goes, "I remember one of my sessions with him that I was sparring a more skillful opponent. And to make up for my lack of knowledge and experience," he said, "I was trying, you know, deceptive and tricky moves that were readily countered." He says, because I was outclassed. And Parker watched me get trounced. He says, "When the match was over, I was dejected. Parker invited me into a small office, and he said, 'Why are you so upset?' And I said, 'Because I couldn't score.' So Parker went behind his desk, and he took out a piece of chalk, and he drew a line on the floor that was about 5 feet long. And he said, 'How can you make this line shorter?'" Right? So he said, "I was thinking of all sorts of different things," and he said, "You know, I even included, you know, going up to the line and like cutting it in several pieces to make it shorter." And Ed Parker just shook his head. And then he took the piece of chalk, and right next to the first line, he drew a second line that was longer than the first. And he said, "Now how does the first line look?" And I said, "Shorter." And he said, "It's always better to lengthen your own line and to improve yourself rather than to try to cut your opponent's and make his shorter." So as I say, I've thought about this a lot in the last 35 years. Made a deep impression on me. Don't worry about them. Don't try to cut or undermine others. Work on yourself. Lengthen your own line. I think about that, honestly, as parenthetically as I watch political debates. Back to the point. Point number one might be lengthen your own line. You do what you do, and don't you worry about them, which leads to point number two, which is the difficulty of this parable, that we all instinctually feel, and that is that some people worked very hard, very, very hard. And then there were others who just kind of, who just showed up later. And they didn't deserve the payoff they got, right? I mean, that's true. That's what this parable is about. And that was Jesus' point. It was actually his point that they didn't deserve it. They didn't earn it. But they got it anyway. And what this is that the very first group who agreed to work for a certain amount of time, for a certain amount of pay, you know, day's work, day's pay, they agreed to this, that's justice. Okay. Everybody else got grace, getting good things that you don't deserve, but you get them anyway. Now, when you get something good, when somebody gets something good that they don't deserve, depending on where you stand, that's either unfair or it's called grace, depending on where you are spiritually. You know, somebody does something wrong, they get a light sentence. If you're that person, it's grace. If you're the victim, it might seem unfair. So depending on where you stand spiritually, this can either set you up for your own life for either trauma or envy or anger or disappointment, being perennially just kind of outraged, and we know those people, you know, irritated. Or, again, depending on your stance, it could create tremendous delight. And it all depends. So point two is really about the dangers of comparative happiness, which is what happened in this parable. And the basic question of, you know, what makes you happy? What makes you sad? Which is a lot of what our faith is about. The interesting thing is with a parable, that first group, you know, when we read it, and we read, you know, they started out happy, right? They started out happy. Everything was great. Day's wage, day's work, happy. It was only after the comparative happiness crept in that their soul soured. And whenever we compare what we have or what we believe we should have in this life against what we believe others have or what they deserve, one of two things kind of can happen. One, pride. Well, my line's longer than yours, so that's good. But that stirs certain feelings. Or resentment. Yeah, my line's shorter than yours. And that is really what a lot of our culture and economy drives. Reminding us again and again, you know, our line is shorter than somebody else's. You have a car, somebody else has a nicer car. You thought your car was nice, but then you pull it up to their car and you're kind of looking at the two and you go, well, that's not so great. I have an iPhone 5. You know, I thought it was pretty great, and I was at a meeting the other day and somebody looks at it, I pulled it out and he goes, oh, man, you got to get an iPhone 6. Where are you? I said, I'm waiting for the 7, you know. No. No. But, you know, you look, I mean, people, we do this all the time. We look at our marriages. We think about our marriages. Is our marriage okay? Is like, you know, I think it's okay. It's kind of, you know, okay, good enough. But, I mean, how does it kind of compare with other people's? You know, are other people's marriages happier? You know, looking at their children, I don't know, their children seem like they have less problems. I don't know. The amount of health that we have. The amount of mobility that we have, you know? And here's the thing. It really doesn't come down to looking at them and just walking around being green with envy. It really comes back to us, looking at our own life and a lot of times feeling worse. And this happens, interestingly enough, even when we compare ourselves with ourselves, with our earlier version of ourselves, and this is called aging. So you can either age kicking or screaming, or you can receive the gift that you are now. So comparative happiness gnaws, and the list is endless in the ways that we do this in our lives. You know, money, financial security, how much money am I supposed to have? Perks, what does he have? Perceived happiness, aging, you know, am I as happy as everybody else around me? You know, aging, popularity, mobility, intellect, sex, social ease, quality of life, vacation time, vacation location. The list is endless. Jesus says this. He goes, you know, this is the point. Count your blessings. Count your blessings. What God has given you. And you know what? Let others have and count theirs. And maybe even join in the blessing. Be happy for them. Be happy for yourself. You know, their child gets into a certain school that yours doesn't. You know, awesome. Awesome. You work harder, somebody else gets paid more. Lucky them. Or, you know, maybe get that job. I don't know. They work hard. You know, you work hard, they inherited theirs. Oh, trust fund kids. You know? Oh, that's, what a blessing. What a blessing. Well, I didn't get that. And then it gets the tough one. You know, I believe that I should have X number of years of life. I believe that I should have X value of health. You know, but then something happens and I feel that I deserve more. I deserve better. Everybody else walking around healthy, happy. You know, Christ says, he goes, you know, somebody else's blessing, it doesn't cut into your pile. And that's the interesting thing. It doesn't take anything away from you. But there are some people, and I bet everybody here knows someone who nevertheless walks around with kind of a perennial low level of resentment, just kind of as the norm, a little bit of an axe to grind, you know? And I guess maybe that, I don't know, maybe that's their blessing. I don't know. This business of comparative happiness, Jesus is clear to point out, poisons your joy, your bliss. It poisons your bliss. It takes you out of the realm of the kingdom of heaven. Right? You go, heaven. That's, you know, that's where we go after we die or something. So point three is really kingdom of heaven. That's really what this whole thing has to do with. It has to do with bliss. That's what, you know, that's what the kingdom of heaven would be, right? And Jesus begins the whole thing by saying the kingdom of heaven is like. And then the whole scenario follows that. The kingdom of heaven. The realm of heaven. So the interesting thing is what he says in many different ways, in many different places, he says, you know, it's not really something after we die. It's not somewhere else. It's not later in some other place or anything. Yes, that too, yes. But we're talking about eternity, which includes now. He says elsewhere, he says, the kingdom of heaven is here. He says, the kingdom of heaven is now. He says, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The kingdom of heaven, bliss, is within you. The kingdom of heaven, bliss, he says, is among you. So it's not somewhere else, someplace, you know. It's within you now. The potential is within us. Bliss. Nirvana. And there's a no-wait line to it. Depending on where we stand and what we do. And what this whole parable is, he's saying you can have this or you can have that. Now, the interesting thing is that I'm going to add this, is that, you know, there's also a no-wait line for hell, too, for the hell realm. Because we all know people, you know, you don't have to go someplace else. You don't have to wait until you die for hell realm. We know plenty of people who are in a hell realm now. No wait line. Angst, stress, fear, worry, longing. No wait line for all of the above. And I don't think that you're in the kingdom of heaven if you're dealing with those things on a regular basis. Same is true for bliss, well-being, joy, peace, contentment, inner freedom, balance, fulfillment, depending on how you live. How you frame your mind, it's a turn of the mind, heaven or hell. So what's your practice? Others have abundant blessing. Wonderful. God bless you. And you know what? And I value my blessings. Door open. Resentment, door closes. Kindness, door opens. Judgment, door closes. And you can feel this. Empathy, door opens. Right? Cold heart, closes. Generosity, door opens. Rationalizing why this might not be the smartest thing to do, and you know, if I might give away the store, door closes. So it isn't later. And it's not only that, but the second that you do any one of these things, as he's pointing out, the second you do it, as you know from your own lives, you can feel it happening instantaneously, so you know it's true. So the kingdom of heaven, next like little sub-point here, is that you put yourself into it, you take yourself out of it. You don't get exited from bliss because some outside entity pulls you out of it, which really leads us to the last point, which is this. You read the story, and there's many different groups. There's the first group, second, third, fourth, and fifth. Which group are you in? Which group are you in? I tell you what, honestly, I see myself in the first group, right? Hard worker, show up on time, responsible, doing a good job. Anybody else here feel like they're in the first group? Just out of curiosity. Yeah, that's okay. No, I do. I do, right? Frankly, we might be feeling like those people in the last group got a little bit more they deserved. Anybody?
Yeah.
One fair, come on. You know. Well. Here's the good news. This is what you're supposed to think. This is why Jesus told the parable. This is how he created it. He created it knowing that, you know what, pretty much every person is going to identify with the hardest worker, who earns and deserves and feels justified. He set up the parable, creating it to feel unfair. He wants us to feel that indignation when we read it. Why? So he can drop the boom of love. As he tells us in so many other ways, in so many other examples, he says, you know what? Here's the good news. You're actually not in the first group. And neither am I. And you know what? You're not even in the second group, or the third group, or the fourth group, for that matter. But every one of us, every last one of us, we're all in the last group. You go, how can he say that? I'm a hard worker, responsible person. How can he say that? You know why? Because every one of us is the recipient of extraordinary, undeserved blessings from every person who's ever come before us, every person who showed up earlier, which is every person in creation, every person in every generation who's gone before us, who worked and who sacrificed and who built and who gave their time and who gave their lives and who gave their resources, that, you know what, we benefit from. That's called society, and here we are, receiving unearned, undeserved benefits, not a bit from our own hard work. We had nothing to do with it, but you know what? We were called into play at the 11th hour. Even the self-made Harvard grad who starts his own business or her own business is in group number four. Because the Harvard grad didn't create Harvard. Harvard grad didn't do all the work to create the science and the math and centuries worth of work that went into the stuff that, you know, that you study to help you become self-made, which is a fallacy. You know, and besides that, he and her, you know, didn't create his genes that gives a certain intelligence. You know, he showed up and the brain plopped in his head. None of us, we didn't create the U.S. Constitution, from which we derive tremendous benefits that gives us the freedom to do what we can do. We didn't fight the British. We didn't invent the electric light bulb. We didn't create the microchip, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The road system, air travel, medicine, dentistry, we reap the rewards of those who do. We just showed up when we were called in. So Jesus would say, you know, so don't get all possessive. Just because you've been here for, you know, for a little while, don't get delusional thinking that this is all yours. And after a short time, now you claim, well, it's all mine, self-made. Isaac Newton in 1676 said, and I bet many of you have heard this, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. Now, that concept, actually, he borrowed from an earlier one that was spoken in 950. But that was even true with Jesus, and who stood on the shoulders of the prophets who went before him. We're late to the game. At the moment of conception, we were picked out of a crowd. Standing idle. Couldn't even stand. Conception. And at that moment, we all won the undeserved lottery called life. And that's grace. We don't deserve it. Different blessings. So, last, and this is also point number 12, by the way, that we're all this undeserving group, you know, fifth group who just showed up. And we're reminded of this in all sorts of ways, not theoretically. We're reminded of this sitting here, just sitting here, as Tim Stewart was talking about, you know, in the very church that we're sitting in. You know, church is a fascinating, really just bizarre organization. There's no other organization in the world, you know, that where you just, one day, you just step into the door and it's yours. This is given to us. This was a gift given to us by men and women who, they never knew us. Because of their hard work, because of their generosity, the ultimate gift of stewardship. Others built this place that they knew was far beyond their means in 1875 to give to people who they knew that they would never met, who just showed up at the 11th hour. 138 years or whatever later, to give to us, to our children, to our grandchildren. And why? Because they followed Christ. They stood on his shoulders. And they saw as he did that he made them aware that what was theirs was really God's, to be shared with great love and grace. And you know, that's exactly what every one of you did who then took these windows and the roof and so forth, and you made your contributions for people 100 years from now. Every one of you who helps to take care of this place, every one of you who helps to support the ministry that we do here for today and for the next generation, that too is called stewardship, which is really sharing grace. Seeing clearly how all this fits together, where we did nothing to earn this, and yet here we are, to be touched by grace. And all we have to do is take care of it, to be a part of that grace, to care for our ministry, this place, the people. That's all that God is asking us to do. Take care of this with grace. to those who show up. And that's what we do. Givers of that abundant grace, happiness, the kingdom of heaven, generosity, stewardship, blessing. Amen.